You are listening to Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks, the podcast, episode 19 for Thursday, April 21st, 2022. JJ Sefton is here with CBD, and today we have a very, very special guest, John Hayward, the columnist and author and writer and formerly known in the blogosphere as Doc Zero, who has over time come out in the open and used his real name. He is now the National Security Deputy Editor for Breitbart.com and has been also a writer for Hot Air as well as Human Events. And we welcome him to the program. Doc Zero, thanks, John Hayward, welcome.
It is really great to be here. Thanks for having me. You know, ACES blog is one of the reasons I became a writer, probably the most important one. It was the blog I first read that just really tickled me. I couldn't wait to read more of it. I loved what he was doing. I wanted to do something like that. And I started as being a commenter at Hot Air and then eventually went professional, quit my day job, and I've been doing it ever since, about 12 years now.
Amazing.
He probably has the good dental plan.
It's an interesting journey to undertake, because that was the age of the blog, and I kind of miss it. I kind of think social media crowded out something that was better, that was happening at the time, where people could set up blogs, network with each other, blog roles were pointing us to one another, we were having conversations, we were linking back and forth to each other's material, and it allowed some great talented writers to make a career for themselves out of essentially thin air. And I think the coming of social media, Facebook and Twitter, especially displaced that, and now there's hardly any traditional blogging going on, but it shook the world in its heyday.
Talking about specifically Ace of Spades, maybe 90% of the conversations are profane and silly, but I would say about 10% of the threads evolve into fascinating glimpses into intelligent people's thoughts about complex topics. And absolutely, Twitter is the worst offender. It destroys any possibility of that kind of back and forth. And it's sad. I agree.
You know, it's interesting.
Yeah, it's too bad.
It's interesting with you mentioned the coming of Twitter and social media. It's almost as if, is it a conspiracy theory? I'm not sure, but it's almost as if it was put there in order to really sabotage this sort of organic, as you describe it, John, growth of the blogosphere and people interacting with each other in a very natural way. And it's just really funny that now all of a sudden you have these mega billionaires, or it used to be, Jack Dorsey, but now it's Agarwal, I forget his first name, and so on and so forth. And they're now, of course, Ajit Pai and whoever else, and they're sort of claiming the mantle of free speech while trying to throttle everybody else's opinion. And so here we are. And it's interesting that all of a sudden, out of the woodwork comes Jack Dorsey to sort of ream out CNN and Brian Stetler over the, and really just tell it like it is, of them fomenting violence in Ferguson in order to get a headline.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, the other thing about blogs is that we could not be silenced. You know, we have our blogging platform. Some people still do it. And it wasn't one unified social media environment. If you were on a blogging platform and they said, we're going to deplatform you because we don't like your views, you just laughed and said, okay, I'll go to another one. And that took like, what, 20 minutes? You know, you migrated your blog somewhere else and you were still up and running. They couldn't silence you. But now that social media has taken over, and especially Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, the big ones, they can and do silence people all the time. And you have no alternative. There's nowhere else for you to go if that's your primary means of communication. I really think something was lost there. And I don't think it's entirely coincidental. I don't think it's a conspiracy to look back at probably the peak moment in blogging, the 2004 election, the Swift Boat veterans, the Dan Rather hoax being exposed by bloggers. That really irritated the hell out of people on the left. And it was not hard to find them at that time saying, we have to do something about this. We have to shut these people up. We have to shut down these alternative methods of communication that are bypassing our gatekeepers. And lo and behold, a few years later, we got gatekeepers again, and here we are.
And it's actually even worse than that, because in addition to the concentration of speech into a few huge things like Twitter and Facebook and so on and so forth, we have a concentration of internet power. The internet service providers are almost uniformly to the left, and they can deplatform at will, essentially. There's a little bit of pushback from the braver souls on the internet, but by and large, if Amazon Web Services wants to shut you down, they will.
Mm-hmm. They'll demonetize you. They'll deplatform you. They have all sorts of techniques now to impose themselves that there weren't back when Ace was getting the blog going and becoming big. When I got started as a writer, Hot Air, you know, my original alma mater, Instapundit, a lot of the others, these were all people that found a new way to talk to the public that seemed for a while as if it was the true promise of the internet, wild and free, uncontrolled. And the quality of your writing and the quality of what you were doing attracted followers and friends and co-bloggers and people that would link to you. And networks were building up that were just amazing. amazing to come out of nowhere and bypass all traditional avenues of publication. And we're back to a much more controlled, gate-kept, moderated, curated experience now, which is not for the better in our discourse. And, you know, I hate to depend on one crazy billionaire to save the day, but I really hope Elon Musk buys Twitter and it changes something. I hope more of that sort of thing happens.
You know, you touched upon 2004. And I think even before that, when you had people like Rush Limbaugh on talk radio being the only sort of alternate voices of truth, or at least of an alternate viewpoint of than the official story that was coming out of the media or out of government. And there was this illusion, like so many things, that the media was this impartial keepers of the truth or bringers of the truth of the who, what, where, why, and when, and nothing more, with the occasional, you know, sort of Shana Alexander and whoever her, you know, the point, what is it, the point counterpoint thing. But, you know, all of that sort of, they sort of lost their minds after 2004. And I think it was just the last election where I forgot who it was, where there was literally an op-ed in the New York Times where it's literally saying we can no longer be impartial. We have to take a stand. So that was just, they've lost their mind and been crazy ever since.
I don't think back to after 2004 also, how many people on the left insisted that election was stolen. You know, you talk about stolen elections and insurrections. They were convinced John Kerry had it in the bag, that somehow George Bush stole it. And once they realized they couldn't make that stick, they started screaming that the bloggers stole it. It was bloggers. It was me. It was Ace. It was you guys. It was everybody who was out there off the reservation that were fooling people. The Swift Boat Veterans for Truth were like a con operation away from John Kerry, who really deserved to win. And that wasn't just gasbaggery on their part. They meant it, and they took action to make sure that it wouldn't happen again. And from there, you begin a story that ends 15, 16 years later with the notorious fortified election of 2020, when they decided to make sure that they had it in the bag by cutting off various avenues of dissent, by making sure that certain things happened. It wasn't even just the crazy ballot box hijinks in 2020. It was all the things they did in the communication sphere leading up to that to make sure that nothing like 2004 could possibly happen again, or 2016.
Well, the careful destruction of any support from the right for Trump during the 6 months before the election proves that. And it was, they took the gloves off, and they weren't even embarrassed by their partisan. That's what shocks me. This is actually a good segue into Ace's article about establishment uniparty Republicans and his disagreement, his gentle disagreement with John. Have at it.
Well, it's a gentle but spirited disagreement, let's say. And I think he makes a good point. I took no offense to what he said. I read through the whole thing. I see what he's driving at. I was castigating the Republican establishment for insincerity and how so many of these never Trump pundits, these people that are never in the trenches and never fight for anything, that always seem to side with the Democrats when everything goes bad, especially in the age of Trump. You know, they still claim to be conservatives, but suddenly conservatives means everything the Democrats want and nothing that anybody else wants. I was taking those people to task for backing out of even the fight over children. I thought this thing that's going on right now in schools, critical race theory, and especially the sexual transsexual indoctrination program that we've uncovered in schools. If you're a conservative in any way, shape, or form, how can you sit this fight out? What else do you think you can conserve if you cede to the other side the idea that parents should not be allowed to raise their own children, should not be allowed to teach them any of their beliefs, that the state will take them when they're five, and start programming them with its notions of sexual identity and racism and political ideology and so on. If you won't fight like the Dickens to stop that, if you won't belly up to that battle and roll up your sleeves, what good are you? What use are you in any way? And how conservative were you ever really if you got to the point where that isn't even a hill that you're willing to die on? I question what anybody in that position ever said that claimed that they were conservative, any book they ever wrote. It all looks more and more to me like a scam. It was just a shuck and jive act they were doing to make some money and pass themselves off as safe conservatives. And when it came time for this fight, what did we get out of those people? Tone policing of us. We noticed this gigantic conspiracy of sexual indoctrination in schools that is so much bigger than people suspected it was, so much more vicious, so much more twisted. And people started calling them groomers. And here come the never Trumpers. Oh, you can't say that. You can't call them groomers. That's populism. You don't want to be a populist. You don't want to be insulting. And I thought my key point is that these people on the right always want to assume the best motives for people on the left, not of their own side. They're willing to call you and me and regular conservatives deplorables and thugs and gun nuts and whatever else. They'll join right in with the left in questioning our motives all day long. But when it comes to a left-wing movement, they will not allow you to question their motives, politely disagree with them, but they will not let you go after them to the degree that groomer implies. That was my point. I think Ace had a good counterpoint where he said some of these people weren't even just con artists in the sense I meant it, or insincere, that they're actively on the other side. They always have been. They've only been pretending to be any kind of conservative, any kind of Republican, any kind of populist or libertarian. It's all been a sham, and they've all been in Democrat pockets forever. And he had some receipts to back up his position. And I don't disagree. I think he's right about some of the people he's talking about. I think it was even more of a scam for them. But I'm really disappointed in the people that I thought were insincere. But for many years before this, they seemed eloquent. They put a lot of work into writing about conservatism. They seemed to understand its means, its methods, its histories. They seemed like they wanted to make a change, to get something done. But then when Trump came along, and ever since then, they've just checked out. Like, they'll never fight for anything real again. And maybe they believed it once upon a time, but now it's so obvious that all they want to be is the safe conservative on CNN. Like, they have no aspiration beyond that.
Jonah Goldberg. Paycheck.
Jonah Goldberg.
Yeah. Jonah Goldberg. And they remind me in some ways of the libertarians who had, you know, these grand plans for America and, you know, freedom and the ability to live one's life without the influence of government. And unfortunately, it devolved into let's all get high. You know, maybe I'm being overly critical of them, but that's what the establishment conservatives have devolved into. As long as they get a paycheck and as long as they can speak eloquently about this high-minded ideal of conservatism, they're happy. But getting down and dirty and fighting for conservative values is beyond the pale.
And I think that's where the questioning of motives comes in. That's why they won't question the motives of the left. That's why they had a conniption fit when the term groomer started catching on for these people that are doing this stuff to kids in school. That implies a bad motive on their part. It implies the worst motive, that they're pedophiles, you know, they're aspiring pedophiles. And they cannot abide that, because if they go along with that, then they don't get invited on CNN anymore. Then they don't get quoted approvingly by Jake Tapper. Then they don't get to talk in forums with people on the left and have bipartisan this and that and the other thing. As soon as you question the motives of the left, you're beyond the pale in their opinion, and you become unemployable and unquotable by them. And that's the line these guys don't want to go across. So they always denounce that kind of language as populism. It's definitely a loaded term. I mean, let's be honest, groomer is a powerful term. It has implications. But one of the fascinating things about that hit me right away in this controversy is that we weren't really allowed to talk about the actual groomers when that was a really big problem in the United Kingdom, still is. But there were huge controversies in the UK about people that were grooming children for sex in an organized way. And we weren't allowed to discuss that. You weren't allowed to talk about it. If you're in the United Kingdom, you got banned and deplatformed and censored and corrected. If you even brought it up, the authorities refused to address the problem. That went on for years. And I would dare say on this side of the pond, there was very little awareness from consumers of mainstream media that any of that was going on. I mean, how many people here knew about the grooming horrors that were happening over in the UK? Rotterdam, I think, was one of the cities where it happened. You know, how many people knew any of that was going on? But now we start seeing that term being tossed around on social media here for the sexual indoctrination crowd. And all of a sudden, oh, you can't call them that. I mean, they're basically saying that it has a unfair connotation. And most of the American public has no idea what that connotation is, because they've never heard of a groomer before. They never heard the term until we started using it to describe the pink hair and nose ring freaks on TikTok and Instagram that are yelling about how they're telling the kids about their sex life in first grade. And if they can't do that, they can't be teachers anymore.
Well, I have to admit that I'm one of the ignorant fools. I knew about what was going on in the UK. I read about it. I was marginally informed. But the supposition that it was occurring in the United States, to me, was ridiculous. It was absolutely beyond the pale. It would not happen in this country. We are far too respectful of children. I mean, we are a nation of lovers of children, of lovers of innocence. And yet I was wrong. I was absolutely wrong. It is happening here. And not only is the word groomer an excellent word, I think we should add pedophile to it, just to make sure that people understand that groomer isn't just an internet meme, that it means much more than just that.
The reason that it was so taboo and such a third rail subject matter over on the other side of the pond was because essentially what was happening in Rotherhithe around the UK was involving basically one group of people, and those are Muslims. So that was something that could not be, they would never ever go after them at all. They couldn't. The other part of it, and it's just, is the whole controversy over Britain's beloved, he's now dead, Jimmy Savile. And Jimmy Savile was this comedian, and he was a DJ, and he became this figure over the course of 40, 50 years that was, you know, he was basically friends with the great and near great, including government officials and the royal family. And the guy was a serial pedophile and rapist. So you have those two intersections, intersectionality, there's a word. You have those two groups of people, especially over there, coming together. And of course, it's going to be a taboo subject. Nobody is going to go near that. The same thing sort of happened here. And it crosses over into other areas, not just in sexual politics, but and also, as we said, with Islam. I remember there was a terrorist attack, or an almost a foil terrorist attack in Times Square. And at the time, Bloomberg was the mayor and Obama was president. And nobody wanted to admit who it was or what it could have been or what it might have been. I think it was a truck bomb that was defused at the last minute. And Bloomberg said, oh, it's probably some right-wing fool who's angry about Obamacare. And then as soon as it was revealed that it was a jihadist who was out to mass murder the infidels, he said, let's not jump to conclusion. So this is the kind of attitude and the kind of insanity that we're up against, and it carries over, as you guys have noted, into people who are supposedly in the blogosphere or in the punditry that are on our side, who will herald all sorts of invective against us, and we should shut up and take it. Whereas you can't, but they will let the left criticize us left night and day. But if to even say peep about them is sort of taboo, and it's bad form, and it'll get you kicked off of the cocktail party circuit.
It's fascinating though that the idea of pedophilia being in some way a topic that should not be discussed is insanity. It's pretty much the safest thing to criticize on the planet.
Yeah.
90% of America would say, damn straight, let's criticize the pedophiles. I mean, this is insanity. And yet, these establishment uniparty Republicans who claim to be conservatives are trying to shut us down when we fairly and essentially impartially point out that, you know something? Pedophilia is bad. Having 6-year-olds being groomed by lunatic teachers who should never have been teachers in the first place, but being groomed by lunatic teachers to be transgender, who the hell knows what you want to call them, and it doesn't really matter.
Sex objects,
basically. It's wrong. It's simply wrong. It's axiomatic that it's wrong. So,
and it has definite effects on these kids, not only psychological, but physical. They're being medically operated on. They're being surgically altered. They're being given drugs, these puberty blockers. It's monstrous. It's absolutely monstrous. And the idea that parents should have no say in this whatsoever is the key point here. If there is a private school somewhere and parents want to send their kids there and they're going to get into transsexualism with the kids in first grade, I mean, at least then there's some parental involvement and awareness and consent. But we're talking public schools, which we're all forced to pay for. This was all done without our knowledge. It was exposed only because of the pandemic lockdowns. The only reason we're having this argument right now is that these dumbasses forgot that they were going to lock everybody in their house with their kids for a year, and the parents were finally going to see what the kids were learning in school through the remote learning connection, and their jaws hit the floor. That's how the critical race theory argument got started a little bit before this thing about grooming. That's how the grooming thing got started. This is all about parents who were just actually given an opportunity to sit in the virtual classroom with their kids, and they're crapping themselves when they realize what's being done to their children. And it's been happening for years, not only without their consent, but with express instructions to the children not to tell their parents. We get this over and over again from the grooming stories. The groomers admit it. The teachers that are doing this will admit it. They boast about it. They're proud of it. Of course, I told the kids, don't tell your parents. It's none of their business. This is between you and me about what I did with my girlfriend last weekend, or, you're being sexually confused or whatever they're doing to them. The parents were deliberately kept out of the loop. This was done without their consent, without their knowledge, and without even the idea that they should have any consent or anything to say about it expressly. There's no representation for you. This was a decision made by your betters in the establishment who are more moral than you and more intelligent than you. A consensus of experts was reached, everybody's new favorite totalitarian phrase. And once they reached that consensus, you were no longer involved in the conversation as an American parent or an American voter. Even if you're not a parent, you're paying for these schools. You should have some input over what goes on in them. Oh, no, you don't. This is all being done without your involvement. You expressly are not allowed to join this discussion. And they're responding with fury now that parents know what's going on, and we're already up to the point where left-wing corporations are threatening reprisals against parents for passing laws against this grooming stuff in school. I mean, how fast all this happened. Heads are spinning, and it's only happening because of the lockdowns.
More to that is that the government now, at the behest of the whoever's controlling Joe Biden in Calorama and the DOJ, are now targeting parents as insurrectionists and potential terrorists. So there you have it. And we're back, the Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks podcast with J.J. Sefton, CBD, and our special guest, John Hayward, otherwise known as Doc Zero. And we're talking about the government literally taking your children away from you because for a myriad reasons. And there was an article that we were referencing that John had written that Ace was talking about and that we were talking about before. And just as what John wrote, it's an important quote. What the grassroots army of parents need right now is representation. They're looking for candidates to support at every level, and they need intellectual firepower, ideological support, a movement that understands their concerns and offers a philosophy to illuminate them. That's where you're supposed to come in, conservatives, from activists to professional pundits. Or do we get another Tea Party debacle where the grassroots get trashed by the establishment and left to the mercy of grifters because they threaten to rock the boat too hard?
Yeah, we all remember that, I hope. The Tea Party was the most exciting thing that happened in politics in an age. It was the dominant story of 2010, the midterm elections back there. They were talking at polling places about how it was like Night of the Living Dead, that the Tea Party voters just kept coming and coming and coming into the wee hours of the night to cast their votes, and they really thought they were going to get something accomplished. But what happened? They were abandoned. They were undermined by the Republican establishment, which was as eager to get rid of them as the Democrats were. Once again, that imputation of bad faith I was talking about was rampant with the Tea Party. There was no pressure in the establishment side to treat them as people with legitimate concerns. There was no concession to the idea that they had a point about runaway government spending and growing government power and how irresponsible and doomed it all was, that they were serious when they talked about wanting freedom, economic freedom, and so forth. Instead, they were terrorists. They were Al-Qaeda. They're racists. Remember, the media was actually inventing and fabricating racist incidents at Tea Party rallies to be able to smear them as racists. You had a Democrat falsely claim they shouted a bad word at him, and I believe it was Andrew Breitbart who debunked that one by offering a reward for any evidence that it happened, and nobody ever came forward to claim the reward. The media would manufacture stories about how there were armed lunatics at Tea Party rallies, and it wasn't true. I mean, they just unloaded on them with every bit of their fury. And the whole point of the exercise on both Republican and Democrat sides, sadly, was to say that this wasn't a legitimate movement with a valid point of view and legitimate positive grievances or positive reasons for the change that they wanted. They were just maniacs. They were lunatics. They were being taken advantage of. And then they were cut loose. They were undermined and destroyed in a couple of years, the most exciting, energetic political movement ever. I'm old enough to remember for a couple of years after 2010, the Democrats are trying to do their own Tea Party. They called it the Coffee Party. It was the saddest, dumbest thing you ever saw, but they tried to cook up their own supposed grassroots movement, and it was fake as hell that they were trying to it was 10 guys in a diner, you know, basically drinking coffee and talking about how much they love socialism, and that was the Coffee Party movement. And when that didn't work, they said, well, I guess we better destroy the Tea Party, and they did. And it was Republicans that helped them do it. It was the GOP establishment that cut them adrift. They didn't have any guidance. They didn't get any leadership. The Republicans didn't assimilate that movement and try to profit from its energy and folded into the Republican coalition, and they were abandoned to the wolves. The grifters moved in, fakes raided them for money, fundraising irregularities, all that stuff happened, and we ended up with the Tea Party as a flaming wreck a couple years after it was so exciting. That's what happens when a grassroots movement doesn't get any buy-in from the organized political parties and establishments. They need representation, because that's how this is supposed to work. We're a representative republic.
Okay, and if these parents... I'm sorry, I absolutely agree with you, but I think the difference between the Tea Party, which was focused primarily on the budgetary mess that the United States has gotten into, and, you know, rampant spending and so on and so forth. But I think the current problem is less in need of high-level representation within the conservative establishment. And I think that's why it has a better chance of succeeding. You know, the typical, you know, not ignorant, but disinterested American voter who votes, you know, during the midterms and maybe for president every 4 years, is going to be much, much more exercised when their six-year-old comes home from school and starts talking about transgenderism and non-binary and, oh, look, daddy has a vagina. That is going to be a much, much more difficult thing to co-opt. They have the skill to do it, but I think it's going to be much, much more difficult.
Yeah, I was going to say that. Well, that's the whole problem, is that, like, who does the GOP represent? It represents big business in the Chamber of Commerce, who are selling us down the river, and, you know, who have sent all our manufacturing over to China and wherever else, and is bringing in cheap labor, and now is champing at the bit that the Title 42 gets totally wiped out and millions of people just rush the border. I mean, we have no manufacturing here. What are all these millions of people going to do? I don't know that they gamed that out, but essentially, and I forgot who it was. There was a candidate running for senator somewhere in I don't know if it was Utah, or I forgot where it was. Somebody's running, and he's basically saying, yeah, we definitely want to, and he was at a fundraiser, and he's saying, yep, we want to bring in millions of people for business, and to hell with the American worker. I mean, it's mind-boggling. We do not have a party, and so there you have it. So it's no wonder that they co-opted that the Tea Party went the way of the dodo. But to CBD's point, these issues, these social issues where it's now your children, and that they're coming after. This is cutting across all sorts of party and ethnic and other lines and uniting people like I don't think anything else ever has done in the past. And
yeah,
I think it's a huge miscalculation.
It's a huge miscalculation on the part of the Democrat Progressive Party. I think transgenderism is a miscalculation. I think that going after children is a miscalculation. And it is going to bite them in the ass. I think it's clear that that's going to happen in November. Whether that continues over the next 2 years into the presidential election of 2024 remains to be seen. But where it is coming from, I think, is clear, and that is the hard left 1 or 2% of the Democrat Party. They have taken control of the narrative to such an extent that the dinosaurs in D.C. have no idea how to combat them, and they're just going along.
I think you're right. The people are motivated, definitely. You can definitely see that. It's a real grassroots movement with a lot of energy, and children and their futures are definitely an issue that will get people motivated and keep them motivated. The problem that I fear is that they're going to turn out in droves. We're going to have another election like 2010, but more so. It could be the biggest tidal wave we've ever seen, maybe. And maybe the Republicans will move in unprecedented numbers, and it will be this walloping defeat for the Democrats. And then the usual stuff starts happening. The Republicans get to Washington, and they find out that they're up against a multi-trillion dollar government that's implacably hostile to them, with a tightly controlled media that's implacably hostile to them. And they start forgetting about all the people that sent them there. And they start thinking, well, I'm going to negotiate with this Leviathan, and I'll see what I can work out that maybe my constituents will be okay with, but that also keeps me politically viable. They're going to have hordes of bureaucrats. You go up against the public education bureaucracy. You say you're going to reform schools and you're going to take care of this grooming stuff. You know what you're going to hear as Mr. Freshly Elected Republican in 2022? Oh, so you want to fire teachers. You must hate children. You're going to fire all the teachers. And then what's going to happen to the children? You monster. And a lot of Republicans will just fold up like spaghetti under that kind of impact. They do it all the time. I think a lot of the stories you're seeing now in the media are designed to marginalize these parents and make them feel like they're alone, like you're the kook if you don't like this grooming stuff, like somehow you're the oddball. And that sets the stage for what Ace likes to call Republican failure theater. That's how you set the stage and draw the curtain back on the usual show where the Republicans win in a landslide. And then they say, hey, sorry, we can't do anything because Joe Biden's in the White House and we don't have a supermajority. So we really tried. But what are you going to do? It's the Department of Education. They're trillionaires. You know, we can't fight them. And it won't go anywhere. And that sense of grassroots energy will mutate into despair. And that feeling that the window of possibility has once again moved permanently. And this is no longer something you're allowed to vote on, like Obamacare. We're not allowed to vote on our health care anymore. That decision has been taken away from us forever. And no matter how bad it stinks and how badly it fails and how much nobody likes Obamacare, the damn Democrats are complaining that it doesn't work. But it'll never go away. You'll never get your freedom back. That's permanent. And the Republicans are okay with that. They made this one half-hearted attempt to repeal it. It didn't work. And then they said, okay, well, that's that. You know, you're screwed now. And all the people who voted to put them in office to fight Obamacare said, what? And now we just accept that. What about big government, the aftermath of the Tea Party? We just accept that we're going to have this irresponsible multi-gazillion dollar government with gigantic deficits forever, and nobody can do anything about it. So now we just get to argue over where to spend the money and exactly how much the taxes should go up. Or immigration. You mentioned that. That's the primal example of this. The decisions for immigration were made by this cabal of left and right-wing interests. The big businesses want the labor, the lefties want the voters, and you and I have nothing to say about it. You can vote until you're blue in the face. You can vote all day long and all night and all the next day, and it doesn't matter, because once the people you voted for get to Washington, they discover that a decision has been made to open the border and bring people in uncountable numbers, and nothing and no one can ever stop that. You know, you're kidding yourself if you think you have anything to say about it, is what the establishment says to people. And for 20, 30 years, we've gotten used to that. We vote against it. We don't like it. We criticize it. We know we're right. We know the government has a responsibility to defend the border. But if you say all that, you're called a xenophobe, and that's the end of the discussion. And it just keeps happening.
We're at a point, though, where what cannot go on will not go on. I think for 30 years, I mean, as deficits rolled up, I mean, we still had, we had a relatively stable society with, you know, interruptions such as, you know, unfortunately 9/11 and certain things here and there. But business as usual always managed to go on. People went on with their lives. They paid their taxes. They kept their head down. There wasn't this, you know, I guess it's before social media and before the internet in a way, or even at the early parts of it. People had led private lives and they did their thing, and sort of politics was sort of for people who were you know, whatever they were, strident, or, you know, who got involved behind the scenes to secretly or not so secretly shift the Overton window and shift society in a certain direction. But now we have trillions of dollars of deficits. We have no oil. We have food shortages. We have the world on the brink of perhaps a nuclear exchange in Ukraine and spreading elsewhere, or perhaps in the Gulf with Iran and Israel. And everything is collapsing in on ourselves. So our elections really... I mean, yes, they're happening, or they will happen, theoretically, if barring some black swan event. But is there some sort of a sea change that's going to happen where, John, what you talk about, this paradigm or this business as usual kind of nonsense comes to an end, and there really is some sort of a change, God willing, for the better, and hopefully not for the worse?
I don't know that this is going to be a sea change, but if there is going to be one, it's going to be transgender nonsense in the schools, because it's a binary question. Are you going to teach my child that there are 57 genders and daddy has a vagina and it's okay to be a girl or a boy or a unicorn? Or are you going to teach math and civics and history and so on and so forth? And there's very little blending of that line. And if, and as I said before, I think that the Democrat establishment has made a fundamental error in pushing this sort of stuff. Whether that is going to be powerful enough to push that sea change, or whether it's going to devolve into exactly what John has unfortunately eloquently described, remains to be seen. But if it's going to come, it's going to come because of this.
That's why I said they need representation and they need support. It will not end with an election, and I hope nobody thinks it will, even if it's an epic victory in November for the right and everything, and even if it's explicitly driven by a huge coalition of parents across all demographics, black parents, white parents, Hispanic parents, Asian parents, if it's everybody all getting together and saying in one voice that we don't want this being done to our kids anymore, and they have a gigantic win, that is the beginning of a battle, not the end. And there will be such a terrible, lamentable tendency to just say, well, that's over now. You know, we beat the crap out of them at the box office or ballot box. You know, they'll get the message. They'll go away, you know, and this is over. But no, that's the beginning. That's when you have to remain involved, make sure the people you voted for do what you sent them there to do. And that's when you need, as I was saying in the article I wrote there, that's when you need the support of a punditry class of academics. You need intellectual firepower. You need reinforcement. Of course, we're conservatives. We're never going to control the media. But you need to hear voices within it supporting you and saying that this is the right thing to do and talking about this as being a real thing that's happening, because it's all too easy for the other side to create a manufactured reality in which your electoral victory didn't matter. They are not going to feel chastened if they lose an election, even if it's explicitly on this issue and on economics and, you know, whatever else people are up in arms about. They will not, the left will not look at that and say, wow, I guess the people are really opposed to what we're doing. We better change our ways. No, that means they're going to redouble their efforts to change the people. They don't back down. They don't think that this means we've been rebuked. They say, oh yeah, well, we're going to get you. We're going to make it so you can't vote against us anymore. We're going to change you so that you won't want to vote against us. And that's kind of how we got here with the kids. They're working on the kids because they can't persuade adults anymore. It's just that simple. The left has very little in the way of persuasive ability to rational functioning adults with jobs. There's nothing you want to hear that they're offering. They're so far beyond any kind of reasonable welfare state type situation. They're advertising the softest of socialism. So, I mean, they don't get adults to buy into this nonsense. They could never have persuaded adults that there need to be 57 genders and 337 pronouns, and five-year-olds need to decide whether they're boys or girls and be medically treated to agree with whatever decision they make. Of course they couldn't have persuaded you. That's the point. They didn't try to persuade you. They did it all to your kids behind your back. They never asked what your opinion was, and you never had a chance to vote against it. That's also largely true of issues like immigration, and I think a growing number of issues in this great reset world after the pandemic. You're not going to be asked. You're not going to be allowed to vote on it. Your opinion will not be solicited. These decisions have been made for you, and it will be done to you unless you take away the power they have to do it.
But that power has been taken away because they're indoctrinating the children, but it's no longer behind the parents' back. It has been exposed. And I think that is the fundamental difference. It is binary. It's either in front of the kids and in front of the parents, or it's gone. And it's such a simple question that I think that the Democrats cannot co-opt it. I do not know. I simply disagree with you, John, but that's probably more of an emotional response than an intellectual response.
Well, I would like that to be true. I would like I hope that's what happens. I'm not arguing against it. I just have my dread.
You talk about the co-opting of youth. I mean, this is not something new. This goes back 50 years. So it's just come as no surprise when Disney or Coca-Cola or whatever, corporation du jour takes these views, you're saying, what the hell is going on? It's Disney. Well, it's not Walt Disney. It's some 20-year-old who's been brainwashed all the way from pre-K all the way through postgraduate who sits in a C-suite and is going to decide things are going to be a certain way no matter what happens to the stock price. So this is why the wolf is at our throats right now, because the rot has been going on for decades now. But it is heartening to see that people are, somehow waking up and saying, my God, what the hell is going on? And they are opposing this. And of course, the government is for sure pushing back. And they're saying, no, we're making this decision. And if you oppose us, if you vote us out, obviously it's a stolen election. So it's illegitimate. So there's that aspect to it.
As a final point, that corporate capture we're talking about, the Disney stuff, that the woke corporations, that didn't happen overnight. That happened over a period of years, and it was done by indoctrinating young people, kids in college, to believe a certain way. The cry bully culture was nourished on campus and then unleashed into the world, and all these kids went out and became workers at woke corporations. A huge amount of money was behind that effort over the course of decades, and constant intellectual and academic support. And if you're going to fight back against a movement like that, you're going to need all those things. You're going to need funding, yeah. You're going to need electoral muscle, elected politicians, yeah. But you're also going to need intellectual support. You need people arguing your case as pundits, as writers, as thought leaders, as tweeters, as whatever they are, in order to nourish the opposition. If they don't have that, the effort is likely to fall apart.
On that note, let's just take a bit of a break and we'll be back. Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks, the podcast. I can't even speak. I'm so excited right now. We'll be back in a minute. Hang in. And we're back with our final segment, CBD JJ Sefton, with the great John Hayward, Doc Zero, as he used to be known as. I love that nickname. And we're gonna shift it up a bit because John is an expert in the national security field, and there's an article that CBD was mentioning that Mexico has decided to nationalize their lithium stocks. And obviously lithium is not only used as a mood-altering chemical for people who have... for mood swings, but it is actually an important component in batteries. And when we say batteries, we mean, of course, electric vehicles. And is this going to be the oil of the future?
I really think it is. I think lithium and rare earths, in general, which are also critical to green energy technologies and electronics and lots of other technologies, those things are all vital resources for the coming century. And they're all basically cornered by China. China controls the market in most of these things, especially in the rare earth department. And hearing the Mexicans talk about nationalizing their lithium reserves is depressing. They have a lot of lithium potentially in Mexico, and private companies were lined up to exploit it. They're not producing any yet, but they had hopes. And unfortunately, the first company that's going to go online is a Chinese company, as luck would have it, that was supposed to start producing lithium. But here comes the Mexican president. He's mad that his plan to seize control and nationalize the energy industry didn't work overall, because that would have been a constitutional change. So he said, well, since that didn't work, I'm going to nationalize lithium. And he had enough support in the Mexican legislature to do that. So it went into effect and it's happening. And as of now, lithium is now the property of the Mexican government. And we really could have used, as North America writ large, us, Canada, everybody, Mexico, South America, we could really have used an intelligently developed lithium industry out of Mexico with private companies working on it, because we definitely need supplies of those things. And that's part of another transition that kind of segues from what we were talking about earlier, that we were not consulted about as a people. You didn't get to vote on this. Nobody came to you and said, hey, how about green cars? How about we use solar panels and windmills instead of reliable energy sources? Nobody asked your opinion. They just did it. And now you're being told you have to accept it. Electric cars were subsidized to an insane degree. And that money was extracted from your paycheck. And you were not asked whether you supported it or wanted to do it or not. They did it without your knowledge or approval. And now here we are being forced into this green energy world. And lo and behold, it turns out all of these things we need for the green energy revolution, solar panels, rare earth minerals, lithium for the batteries, all the stuff, everything really to a comical degree, is actually controlled by either communist China or by authoritarian governments that are going to use the leverage that we're giving them. We are handing authoritarians around the world a huge amount of economic leverage over this green economy that's being foisted upon us. And very little of what that economy requires is either manufactured or even sourced to the United States. We're more than we were with oil and the Arabs. We're being placed at the mercy of authoritarian regimes that will absolutely use that economic leverage against us in the years to come.
It's funny because these authoritarian regimes are mostly in the third world, especially in Mexico. And it's sort of the rationale is, as we were talking about with education, with the brainwashing of our children, is an offshoot of critical race theory. And it states that America has always been imperialist. It's never been a legitimate country. It's been an oppressor nation. So we have to sort of give our wealth to the third world. And so in essence, there's a philosophical or ideological underpinning to this allowing of these now vital resources to go to the third world, because, you know, we don't deserve it, and we've plundered enough, and they've got to have it now. Unbelievable.
Yeah, there's a certain glee, right? Like the shoes on the other foot. You imperialists are finally getting a taste of your own medicine now that you're dependent on China and South America for all the things that you're going to need in the future. But that's not something any sane, rational person should be looking forward to. The last thing in the world that we want is to be at the mercy of these regimes or to be scrambling for sources of power that are inadequate. We're condemning ourselves to use unreliable green energy instead of the stuff that we know works. And meanwhile, while we're doing that, China, which is the supplier of all this stuff we need for energy. What are they doing? Well, they just had a meeting yesterday. And at the meeting of the Chinese government, they said, we're going to dig 300 million tons more coal, and we're going to build nuclear power plants. They're not enslaving themselves to green energy. They're laughing at us. I mean, they can scarcely contain their hysteria as they watch us condemn ourselves to this low energy, low industry, poorer future that the Greens are foisting on us. And the Chinese just laugh uproariously. And they send a couple of communist toadies to a climate change meeting. And they say, oh, yeah, we care about climate change a lot. You just watch. You know, in 20 years, we're going to go all green. You just wait and see. And then they turn around and dig out so much coal that the sky turns black across the third world. It's not just in China. They've been building coal plants like they're going out of style all over the third world through this Belt and Road Initiative, which is their big infrastructure program. So they're increasing the world's consumption of coal-fired energy and just laughing themselves sick while we run around and build windmills and solar farms and condemn ourselves to darkness. I mean, it's just ludicrous. And the final topping, the maraschino cherry of insanity on all this, is that we have to do business with China to get all the stuff we need for the green energy future.
And in fact, it's even worse than you've described, because going hand in hand with their embracing coal and oil, they're growing their military and they're expanding into the South Pacific. And there's a little country called Australia in the South Pacific that is the world's largest producer of lithium. And whether the Chinese want to eventually blockade Australia or isolate it from its neighbors, who knows? I would put nothing past them. But it just follows your point that they do what they want. They play the long game, and they are clearly trying to corner America or box America into an unsustainable green energy world that will decrease our standard of living, increase their standard of living, and decrease our standing in the world.
And it provides them with more power for industry and military. As you just pointed out, they're building up their military. Sorry, guys, but tanks don't run on solar panels. There's no such thing as an electric-powered fire jet. China is going to have all the energy it needs to drive a massive military machine, and we're just doing blinding insanity, like, you know, holding transgender training sessions for sailors and letting our fleet fall to pieces while the Chinese are building up. It's not going to be much of a fight when they finally decide they want to knock us over after what they've been doing to us, unless we change course very quickly.
You know, I would say there are a couple of things. One, you know, you talk about intangibles like the transgender issue and the sexualization of our children that has awakened, hopefully, please God, a sleeping giant among the population here. In fact, what happened with the invasion of Ukraine and the attempted takeover of Ukraine by Russia is it exposed the absolute insanity of green energy policies that Germany had put itself under. And now Germany is now scrambling, you know, it's kind of throwing that by the wayside, at least for the time being, to build nuclear power plants and to bring in more oil and to bring in more fossil fuels. So that has exposed a vulnerability that people are seeing that perhaps never saw before and thought that, well, you know, the unicorn farts and windmills and all this pixie dust is going to be wonderful and oil is dirty and horrible. But, you know, when they start freezing to death and when, because Russia is now master blaster and turning off the gas and issuing an embargo, they're saying maybe we should rethink this. To the military point side of things, it's not really related necessarily to energy, but yeah, it was kind of alarming news that China has now signed an agreement I don't know who owns Guadalcanal, if it's Micronesia or Papua New Guinea,
the Solomons,
it's an independent country. Islands. They're going to build a military base where we spent blood and treasure, you know, 80 years ago trying to liberate. And that's just, to me, that's just an insult and just is intolerable. But that said, is it fair to say that the Chinese military is an unknown entity from what they from what we see of them and what we gather of them. Yeah, they look mighty and fearsome, especially in light of what John you just said about our own military, which is, you know, pregnancy flight suits and parading around in drag. Look what happened to the Russian army in Ukraine. I mean, if China invades Taiwan, and we know that China's government and its military is rife with corruption all over the place, can we expect their military to perform along the same line, given the fact that the Taiwanese are probably going to defend their island to the death? So it's kind of a race to the bottom. I mean, are we going to be inept and wipe ourselves out, our military, or are they going to do it first before we can possibly go toe-to-toe with them? It's a crazy situation.
I really hope they're thinking that way. I really hope the Chinese war planners, and there's some evidence that they are looking at what happened to Russia and Ukraine and saying, whoa, wait a second, you know, maybe some of these tactics that we've largely cribbed from Russia and some of this equipment we've largely patterned after Russia doesn't work as well as we were really hoping that it would. And maybe they're also learning a few lessons about the advantages moving to the defender. Warfare's like that. Warfare swings back and forth across the centuries with attack and defense, with protection and aggression, switching sides and different modes of warfare becoming more and less possible. And one thing Ukraine is demonstrating is that with modern weaponry, motivated defenders can do a lot of damage to a theoretically vastly superior attacking force. And the Chinese had just about talked themselves into thinking that they had overwhelmed our naval and air advantages in Taiwan's natural defenses, and it was now thinkable that they could move in and take the island without completely obliterating it, which would not be their preference. They want to take it. They don't want to nuke it. You know, but they just about convinced themselves they could do that, and here comes the Ukraine debacle for Russia, and hopefully maybe they're having some second thoughts. But then technology could change again, and that calculation could very easily change in some manner of years. New technologies, AI, drones could make it so that the advantage swings back to the attacker, and no longer do you see what's happening in Ukraine as the likely next war. Other thing about China that's interesting is that they don't have a lot of practical mass combat experience in the modern era. You know, they don't really know what they're doing when it comes to fighting a modern war, and theoretically we do because we've been involved in a few of them over the years. But the one real test of their ability was in the Doklam Valley in the Himalayas. And it's this really bizarre incident that didn't get as much attention here as it probably should have. But a couple of years ago, there was literally like a fist fight between Indian and Chinese soldiers. And the Chinese were aggressing on Indian territory, and the Indians decided they'd had enough. So they had a big argument that escalated into a brawl with sticks and improvised weapons. They didn't use guns because they didn't want it to become a military engagement. And the Indians beat the ever-loving crap out of the Chinese. And the Chinese were really surprised by this. They had been believing their own press that they were wolf warriors and that their soldiers had become invincible. And the Indians just pureed them in this fist fight that they had. So that gave them a little thought at the Chinese high command level that maybe their military quality of soldier is not what they want yet. But they do have a gigantic advantage in numbers. And the Chinese are very organized. And increasingly, they're taking a significant advantage in vital military technologies. So you couple that with energy supremacy because they don't buy into this green energy crap that the rest of us do, and you've got a problem.
You know, it's funny. Maybe it's anecdotal. Maybe it means nothing. Maybe it means something. Remember a couple of months ago, China announced that it was, and it touches on the sexual politics here, China was going to ban sissy boys from its movies, from its television, from wherever. And if anybody has, if you have a sissy kind of a haircut, you'll be, you know, the secret police will haul you off to the Chinese gulag, and that'll be the end of you. So maybe there's a lot of things going on behind the scenes in that society, and not just in their military, that are very, you know, that are very interesting, shall we say. I mean, what's happening in Shanghai with the lockdowns, I can't believe it. That has to do with the virus. I've got to believe that that's some sort of a political move between the Xi supporters and Xi himself and those who do not like his nouveau Maoism, shall we say, and trying to become the next emperor of China. Isn't that something to do with coronavirus? Maybe it does, but after what we've seen here with the severity of it, you gotta wonder.
Yeah, there's a lot of political dimensions to what's happening in Shanghai and what's going on with China. And part of it is that the Communist Party can't admit it was wrong about lockdowns, and they can't admit that they were lying. Because let's face it, that's what we're really learning here. By a funny coincidence, every Chinese city that has a large population of foreign observers who can't be blinded and silenced by the Communist Party winds up having gigantic coronavirus outbreaks. And meanwhile, China says, oh, we obliterated it. You know, man, we never had that many cases at all. Hell, nobody's died here in 2 years from the coronavirus. That's all you Westerners. You don't know how to fight this disease. And then every time a Chinese city like Hong Kong or Shanghai that's got a lot of public exposure has an outbreak, it's just as it was here. The same number of people get sick and die as anywhere else in the world. So, I mean, yes, they obviously have been lying all this time, and it's to the great shame of groups like the World Health Organization that they spread Chinese propaganda, that they believed it even though they knew it wasn't true, and they enforced things like lockdowns on the rest of the world. So the Chinese Communist Party cannot not now change course and say, hey, you know what, we're wrong. We need to learn to live with this virus the same way the rest of the world does. And they're ready to make their people suffer as much as it takes to make that political point and keep insisting that they and they alone have the power to control this virus because they're authoritarians. They think this is a clash between authoritarianism and capitalist democracy, and they're not going to yield this particular debate point, no matter how many of their own people suffer
right.
and die.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I think actually the long game is taking over Hong Kong completely. And I think that the crackdown in Shanghai is at least in part an example to the world that, oh, it's not just Hong Kong that they're going to crack down on. They're going to crack down anyone in China because COVID is so important. And, you know, they're good corporate citizens and good global citizens. But the reality is that I think that the long game is the complete subjugation of Hong Kong. And it's going on now. I know that plenty of expats in Hong Kong are planning on leaving. They're driving out the West. They want Hong Kong to be a source of foreign capital, but without its pesky ideas of freedom.
It's funny. Exactly. I thought you were talking about the United States there for a moment. Isn't that what's going on here right now,
well,
gentlemen?
Yeah, that's
you
true.
Know, I think we've reached the end of our hour. I think unless you have some parting thoughts there, John.
Yeah, I'm going to put John on the spot. Give us 30 seconds on what you think of Governor DeSantis and who the Republican nominee for president in 2024 is going to be.
Well, I think Governor DeSantis has done a terrific job objectively, and he's also a sharp political operator. He knows how to pick a fight. He knows how to win a fight, and he's doing things that matter. He's actually moving the ball down the field, which far too many Republican politicians don't do. I think he's definitely a formidable contender if he wants to run for president. The trick always is that when you get a governor that looks great in every other way, sometimes you throw them on the presidential stage and the magic doesn't happen. Not saying that's his fate, but we all remember Scott Walker, if you can think back to when he was the Republican superstar governor in his presidential campaign flamed out just because there wasn't any energy or electricity there. He just didn't catch fire. That's a possibility. The only way to find out is to try if he really wants to go for it. I think it's going to be a lively primary, to say the least, coming up at us. There are going to be some divisions in the Republican side to fix. The Democratic primary is going to be interesting. You know, if they really are going to try to run Joe Biden again, they're going to have a lot of trouble from an increasingly fed up and disgusted Democrat base that thinks he's a boat anchor around their necks and they can't believe the party would even think of running him again. We don't know if he'll be capable of running for office. It doesn't look good right now. You know, with the things that are happening to him right now, he's deteriorating. So I don't know if he's realistically going to be the nominee. Kamala Harris most assuredly will not be. The Democrats will not even try to foist her on the country as a presidential candidate. So some crazy stuff is going to happen on that side before the big matchup. So it's going to be a lively contest to watch. But I hope whoever it is, whether it's DeSantis, Trump, or somebody else we don't know about yet, I hope they just remember that these things are important. These issues are important. You got to do stuff that moves the ball. That means you're going to have to speak a little populism. You can't tone police yourself into silence. You're going to have to talk to people in a language they understand, and you're going to have to make sure they understand the stakes and that you present a real alternative, that you're not just talking up a storm here, that you're going to do something, and you got to tell them what you're going to do. I think Trump could have done that in 2020. He really didn't. You know, that isn't the way that campaign went. I think he could have done better if he had done that, and I really hope that the next campaign, if it's his or anybody else's, learns from that lesson.
CBD, John Hayward, Doc Zero, J.J. Sefton, gentlemen, thank you so much for being here. It was a pleasure.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for listening, folks.
This has been the Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks podcast, April 21st, 2022, and we'll see you next time.